Welcome to the Strassman Files on Book Radio. I'm Mark Strassman. Our guest today is Stephen Holtzman, author of Digital Mosaics, The Aesthetics of Cyberspace. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Let me ask you first about the relationship between this book, Digital Mosaics, and your last book, Digital Mantras. What's the relationship between the writing of them and the material in them?
Digital Mantras, which was my first book, really looked at the creative process and how you could use the computer as a partner to create new sorts of forms of expression, whether it be music and painting, in other words, more traditional forms, or new forms like virtual worlds. At the end of that book, I talked about the idea of a new aesthetic, or what I call the digital aesthetic. And it's that idea that became the foundation for Digital Mosaics. And so the idea of Digital Mosaics was to expand that from a chapter into a whole book and address a number of changes that have happened since 1994 when Mantras first came out, the web, which really didn't exist then, virtual worlds and the proliferation of that, and a lot of other changes in the technology. So it's an up-to-date look at the issue of the aesthetics specifically.
So in a way, the first book was really about standalone, about the aesthetics of computing in a standalone environment. And this is about the aesthetics of computing in a network environment.
Well, certainly the network has been a major change in the last few years. I mean, the Internet and/or the web are near ubiquitous now, and everybody's I think becoming familiar with them and touched by them, which is why I think Mosaics is very pertinent today, because we're all sort of getting exposed to cyberspace.
What's the difference between what people get out of reading Digital Mosaics and what they get out of reading other books about cyberspace, particularly ones that sort of are how-to books or what to buy books?
Well, I think most of the books that are written today are either in the category of, as you say, how-to books, or they often, when they project the future, are talking about the ability to have little appliances, like a little digital computer that's on your wristwatch, or phones that are computers, and so on and so forth. The idea of Mosaics is to look not so much at how content will be delivered, but at the content itself. So in other words, how will what we create and say be different given digital technology? Not how will it be delivered differently, in other words, not how will news be delivered to me anywhere instantaneously, but how will the very structure of news and information change, how will the structure of human expression change, and that's the theme of Digital Mosaics, and it's, I think, very different from anything out there today.
Is there anything here along the lines of changes in quantity becoming changes in quality? Do things become transformed when the megahertz reach a certain level?
The technology is certainly one of the barriers to fully realizing the potential of the digital medium. So on a slower machine, it's very difficult to create an immersive virtual world that you can disappear into, that has intelligent digital actors that you can interact with. The things that I think will really ultimately unleash the power of the digital medium. So faster computers, more bandwidth to the house, all these sorts of things will enable the sort of new digital world that I think will really, again, demonstrate the potential of digital medium in the next few years.
Okay. It seems to me that the major point that you want to make in the book is that we do not yet have full-flowered digital media, but what in fact we have is the delivery of previous media, legacy media, through a digital network. Is that a fair restatement of what you're saying?
No, that's exactly right. I think today we're sort of rooted to the past. So the very idea of a web page is from the print medium. I mean, pages are really not digital. They're a very print-oriented concept.
Right.
Today we're talking about channels. Various people are talking about delivering information through channels.
Right.
That's a concept that's borrowed from television.
Right. It's one generation of media, but it's still not specific. It's not indigenous to the digital media.
Exactly. And that's not totally surprising. Even back in the 60s, Marshall McLuhan talked about how every time we encounter a new medium, the first thing we do is approach it in terms of the old. So when we first discovered TV, we used it in the format of theater or very much like radio talk shows. Before, it was a long time before you had programs like MTV that used fast cut editing and techniques that were totally video in a sense.
Right.
Today, we're using the digital medium in a sense to recreate in a slightly different form, prints are using concepts from television. We haven't yet gotten to the point where we have the equivalent of MTV in the digital medium.
Okay, I want to focus on McLuhan also, but let's focus exactly on that quick cutting in MTV that the technology made possible a new aesthetic, and the new aesthetic then creates a consciousness that's based in that new aesthetic that's based on the new technology. How is that going to emerge for digital media?
Well, I think, yeah, there's two pieces to that. I think in the case of MTV, the technology was probably there long before 1984, which is when MTV sort of hit the scene. And it was a conceptual leap that was really required. So I think, as we discussed a few minutes ago, there certainly are some barriers to the technology. For example, if you go to the advanced research labs and look at things, there is some incredible sort of horsepower that that exists there, that the technology really isn't a barrier, at least for an elite few who have access to that sort of technology.
Right.
Nonetheless, the thinking is still mired in the past.
Right.
So most of the fancy graphics workstations that are being used to create, synthetic worlds are focused on recreating things that look like the real world. The ability to create a totally abstract world that, for example, is like fractals, there's some people exploring that, but it's really the exception rather than the rule. So we need to sort of change the way we think about the medium and then apply that to new forms of expression. And that's sort of the conceptual leap, and that's going to be much more difficult than the technological leap.
Okay. Separating from technology for a second, the issue, as you've stated, is partially the use of old paradigms, old aesthetic paradigms, in new media. To what extent do you think any of the problem is caused by sort of the sociology of the creative milieu, namely that the people who understand the technology aren't people who are either making the economic decisions about how to deploy it, nor are the people you think of as strictly as artists, creative writers, always as conversant with the capabilities of the technology as they might be. And so the task is getting all of those groups together in some functional way so that the power of the technology can be used in the service of the aesthetics and the commercialism.
Clearly, the really complex digital worlds of the future are going to be much like the productions in Hollywood today. So you need a collaboration. You need advanced technologists who might come out of Silicon Valley or somewhere else. But then you need to combine that with the creative talent
right.
that exists, for example, in Hollywood. That's coming together even though, today, the summer blockbusters that we're seeing have a predominant theme of sci-fi, full of special effects. That is a combination of Hollywood talent and Silicon Valley talent, for example.
Right.
Nonetheless, it's got a very focused commercial sort of appeal. It's still in the sort of cinema or movie format, and it's not what I would really call a digital world. The difference is, for example, being that no matter how sophisticated the dinosaurs jumping through Lost World of Jurassic Park or the effects in some other sci-fi movie, it's still a movie. And a digital experience has the potential to have qualities that are totally different. For example, you can interact with the medium. So rather than observing dinosaurs jumping across a field on a screen, you can become part of the scene, immerse yourself in it, and become, in a sense, an actor in the show. That is totally different than reading a book, watching TV, or going to the movies. That's some of the potential of the digital medium that is barely being explored today.
Let me explore a part of that, though, then, right now. There seem to be two schools of thought on this interactivity, or interactive storytelling, as it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that people want to decide what happens in the story, or do you think that the reason they go to a media event is to have a story told to them?
I don't think one is exclusive of the other.
Okay.
The fact that we will have interactive storytelling or interactive digital worlds won't mean that there won't be a role for newspapers or more traditional sorts of entertainment, which are more passive. On the other hand, I think there are a number of people exploring immersive virtual worlds that are, in a sense, arcade games. So you enter, for example, a flight simulator, and you fly a plane, and you might actually fly with a number of other people and interact and compete in a world that is totally digital, totally immersive, and very much not passive experience. In other words, you're very much a participant in the whole experience, and what you do changes the way the story unfolds. So I think, again, when I get really excited about the digital medium, it's doing things that are really unique to it and finding new forms of expression that we really couldn't have done in prior media, independent of whether or not those prior media still have a role in the future. I don't think that TV or movies are necessarily going away, certainly not short term, but I do think the potential of the digital medium is to do things that those media don't do, and that's the whole theme of the book.
One particular example that you dwell on to a certain extent is music, and how digital tools in music, as they've evolved, have made it possible to reach new forms of musical expression. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, starting with the sample of, maybe we even listen to this Bach style music first.
Okay.
And you can sort of explain to us how that figures into to what you've been saying.
Situation where the computer studied the work of Bach. It was using software developed by a gentleman named David Cope at the University of Santa Cruz in California. It studied the work of Bach, extracted the rules, and then composed following those rules, or in other words, in the style of Bach.
Right. What's
interesting there is not so much recreating things that sound very much like Bach, in fact, could easily be mistaken for Bach. What I find interesting about that is it demonstrates the sort of level of sophistication that the computer can arrive at. So using this process where you take rules, turn them into software,
right,
the computer can compose very sophisticated compositions.
Did the computer also play that music? Or synthesize it through a MIDI channel?
In that particular case, yes. But for example, I think, again, the interesting thing as a contemporary creative artist is not to recreate Bach's music, but to create your own music.
Okay, you've got an example of that, too. Why don't we listen to that from
Gottfried Michael Koenig?
Exactly.
In that example, what Gottfried Michael Koenig is doing is developing his own set of rules, and in fact having the computer write a piece of traditional music, in other words, music that's written down and then is performed by a traditional orchestra. But he was the first person to really develop sophisticated composing software and then use the computer to create totally new compositions in the style that he defined by a set of rules. I think what we're evolving to, though, today is a new breed of artists who are using the computer to not only compose the music, also perform it and do it in styles that are, you know, much more contemporary. So a third example that we have is a composer who's creating sort of new age ambient music that is totally composed by the computer, performed by the computer. And in fact, what's interesting about it, the computer will do this forever. So once you turn it on, the computer composes and composes and plays and plays and plays and plays and plays, and it becomes a sort of environment that is unending, very different from traditional music. Left to its own, the computer would go on for hours and hours, and it's sort of like a screensaver.
Right.
It's an audio environment. But again, what's really interesting, it's a totally new way of composing music. Brian Eno, who works with U2 and David Bowie and a number of others, who created sort of the ambient music genre in the 70s, is using these same techniques to create music. And what he talks about is the idea of a recorded piece that is the same every time it's played over and over and over, like on a CD,
right,
is a new concept. Prior to 100 years ago, everything was fresh every time it was played, and it was never repeated identically. Well, that's what we're bringing back when you introduce the computer. Every time it plays that composition, it comes up with a slightly different interpretation, bounded by the rules the composer set, but never the same twice.
Okay. One of the major concepts of digital culture is that it's all ones and zeros, and it's all rules. What you've just described as the evolution of computer-generated music, I'm wondering how transferable that is to the visual, to the literary, to other formats where the same principles of rule understanding and generation and performance could easily exist as well.
It's very transferable. In fact, not only is it transferable, but for example, whereas you can imagine creating music through traditional means, it's impossible to create a virtual world of any complexity through any other means, meaning that in order to take a world where the way it works is each eye in a virtual world, in other words, is projected, there's 30 frames a second being calculated, you could move in an infinite number of directions. In a sense, you can't really predict the scene that will unfold because it really depends on the person and how they interact with that world. You have to have the computer synthesize that world. And the way you do that is by taking a set of rules, turning them into software, and then the computer follows those rules to create a very complex virtual world. So as we move to sort of new digital media, it is absolutely required that we change the process of creativity. That was part of the theme of my first book, Digital Mantras, but it is, again, part of the digital aesthetic. We have to change the whole process and then create and think in new and different ways.
Can you be more specific? Change it from what to what and how?
Well, I think, again, in the visual arts or in a movie, we tend to think of things as being pretty much static. You know, you film something and you then cut it and you have a piece of celluloid that is maybe a great movie, but it's the same every time. When you do the same thing with a painting or you write a book, it's a static object. Digital worlds are, I think, at their essence, dynamic and ever-changing. Beneath it is a computer that is computing millions of times a second, so that even when there is nothing changing, it is sitting there doing something. That's just the nature of computing. To really unleash that nature is to have the worlds not just being static, but changing all the time, with the computer constantly driving that through its processes of computation. So I think it's static worlds are inherently, in my mind, undigital.
Right.
Dynamic, changing worlds, evolving worlds, worlds that you become that you interact with and that change based on what you do. Those are all things that exploit the digital medium and are what I call part of a digital aesthetic.
Okay. Do you think there's a limit to how much constant transformation the human brain can safely or successfully absorb?
Well, I suspect there will be all sorts of psychological studies about how much we can absorb, but I think what's kind of interesting is there was a time that the idea of having sub-second edits in video would have been thought of as a totally absurd idea, that
right.
No one could ever track edits that were less than a second. Well, today, because of MTV, and as we talked about these fast-cut edits, you often have edits that are even as short as a tenth of a second.
Right.
It's not only part of MTV, but it's part of things you see on, sort of mainstream commercials, mainstream television programs, NYPD Blue, others that have sort of institutionalized this whole sort of approach. And I think it demonstrates that our sort of capacity to absorb things is often much greater than we might anticipate. And so I guess if I were to look positively at the digital medium, I think it will potentially unleash capabilities, perceptual capabilities, that we barely even know we have today, and in a sense open up parts of the mind and change the way we think in ways that we can't even imagine today. And again, that's what's really, to me, exciting about the digital medium.
Can you say something about what you think about the possible problems or effects of uneven distribution of digital media and access to it? There are some people who have email, cellular phones, fast cuts, totally, just in the United States, just within a mile of where we are now. And others who are still watching, if not black and white, they're all watching color television at least, but they don't have access to that technology. Although to a certain extent, even the poorest people do. Is there an emerging problem or opportunity or effect that you see from the uneven virtualization of different classes of people's lives?
I definitely think that's an issue. I'm not sure that the digital technology is. And the sort of stratification that will occur
right.
is that different from the sort of stratification we have today, like you say.
It goes along the same lines, almost exactly.
Exactly. So I think, you know, there are some who are very positive, and there are the things that I think, for example, the web enable is anybody to open up a website and distribute their ideas in print form or in music or whatever. And the cost of distribution, you no longer have to be sort of blessed by Warner Brothers or Sony in order to have your music distributed across the web today.
It still helps.
Depends on your objectives. If you have mass audiences and that is sort of what you're trying to achieve, the marketing engine still has value. But I think if you have smaller audiences, the web allows you, ultimately, I think, to potentially find that audience and allows much smaller groups and people who don't have that sort of, let's say, money or distribution clout to distribute their ideas. Nonetheless, there are barriers, both economic, because not everyone can afford all the technology you need to do that.
Right.
There are, you know, also barriers in terms of, you know, just general understanding and training and education and all those things that are, again, I think part of a broad-based problem with society today. Again, I don't think it's unique to the digital medium. It may perhaps be exacerbated by it, but it's an endemic problem in our social stratification.
Tell us a little bit about Perspecta, Inc., of which you are the president and CEO.
Perspecta is a company that I founded a year and a half ago with some students from the Media Lab.
That would be the Media Lab at MIT?
The MIT Media Lab, exactly. And what these students were doing at the Media Lab was developing totally new ways of organizing and navigating through information in a visual, immersive, sort of 3D environment. So instead of looking at pages, you fly into information, and it appears around you, and you interact with it in a way that you can't do in print or any other medium. So the attraction for me, and I think vice versa with these students, they met me because of this sort of idea that I am an evangelist for, which is finding new ways to exploit the medium to do things that couldn't be done before.
Right.
And so the idea here is, let's not think in terms of pages and clicking from page to page to page and static hierarchical lists. You know, today when you use a search engine, you do a query and you get this long, long list of items back. Or you go to a site and you click, again, from page to page to page and you have no idea where you are. It's a big problem when you have a lot of data. What we're trying to do with Perspecta is totally change the way people think about interacting with information, navigating through cyberspace, and doing it based on metaphors or concepts that are not based on old media. And so it is sort of myself taking the ideas that I've been sort of evangelizing, that I talk about certainly in Digital Mosaics, and putting them into practice and making them widely available. So today, for example, if you go to Perspecta's website at, you know, www.perspecta.com, you can download a client, and I have a nonlinear space that you can fly through a text that is nonlinear talking about nonlinearity. So I use the medium to write about the medium.
Right.
So although that's a subject I cover in the book, it's very hard to talk about nonlinearity in a compelling way in a linear format. And what I try to do with what I call the Digital Mosaics space that is on the web today is talk about nonlinearity in a nonlinear medium so that you actually experience what I'm talking about as you read it.
Is there material there about subjects other than nonlinearity?
That particular space is focused on nonlinearity. At Perspecta today, there are multiple sort of what we call information spaces that are available. There's one where you can fly through movies, which may again appeal to certainly the LA crowd. We have a database of tens of thousands of movies, and you can fly towards a subject of interest, action films or documentaries or horror films. And what happens is as you move towards something, subtitles come up, or subtopics, and you move towards those, and ultimately movies start appearing, and ultimately you can, in the case of that customer we're working with, Real.com, you can preview or purchase a movie on the internet and have it delivered to you.
Presumably the same technology would allow you to move towards products other than movies and have them order them and have them delivered to you once UPS, of course, is up and running again.
No, exactly, and we're doing that. Another of our accounts is customers that we're working with is Sabre, which is one of the largest travel information companies, subsidiary of American Airlines. Their goal is to provide ways for both travel agents and consumers to have a totally different experience and make it engaging so that, you know, this idea of what's called electronic commerce,
right,
it's really not very compelling today. So a problem to get people to shop on the web is to make it more interesting and more engaging. And again, from a commercial point of view, that's one of the applications for the prospective technology. So,
well, eventually you'd even be able to align or arrange political candidates along a continuum from the far right to the far left and let people find their own level there.
Absolutely.
And, have them stick out a little basket and put money in or give them votes or whatever.
Well, if I were sort of get a little grandiose in the vision, I think what we're trying to do with Prospecta, or what I'm trying to talk about in Mosaics, is that in maybe it's 5 years or maybe it's 15 or 20 years, everything we see will be different. We will no longer think in terms of flat pages and click from page to page to page. The digital medium and the power of it will be unleashed, and the very experience will be different. It will be non-linear, it will be immersive, it will be interactive, it will be unlike anything we've seen before. Prospecta is an example of that, and I think has very broad applicability, as we've just discussed, to anything from studying history to looking at shopping for movies to shopping for, you know, tours, all sorts of different applications. But for example, the digital medium and this interactivity, entertainment will change. Movies and what people expect. Again, there may be a role for movies in the future, and I'm sure there will be, but much more engaging experiences will be possible, and it will unleash totally new forms of expression, just like movies represent. And in a sense, if we think about movies today, you couldn't have imagined the sophistication of, let's say, the effects and the quality of I'll use Jurassic Park, since you mentioned it earlier, from the sort of Nickelodeon sort of stage of movies at the turn of the century. Similarly, we're at the Nickelodeon stage today of the digital medium, and we have barely scratched the surface and can barely imagine where it's going to take us to. But again, there's some very, very advanced research at various labs, places like IBM, the Media Lab at MIT, and we're getting glimpses of those possibilities, and that's what I try to talk about in Digital Mosaics.
Okay, and in fact, the biggest change in terms of what's important to people from the Nickelodeon era to the MTV era and beyond is the consciousness, the thoughts and feelings that are generated in humans as a result of their interaction with these media.
Absolutely.
And what that implies about the next few steps up and what that's going to do. And that's what you've helped explain to us in Digital Mosaics. So I want to thank you and wish you well in your future research.
Great. Thank you. Pleasure being here.